learned it from your elders. It's got a real meaning to it because you got taught the right way. There's a certain way that you dance in order for it to be your own. That's the only way that I know how to do it. It's the way that my forefathers have taught me.
Alaska Native music and dance traditions are expressions of culture and spirituality. We'll introduce the Nupiaq people who carry on these traditions. A cultural resurgence began in the 1960s and 70s, and today the Nupiaq drum is being used in a new way. This is an Earth Songs documentary, a Nupiaq drum and dance, a cultural renaissance.
For the respect of the song and the composer, we sing it the way it was intended to be sung.
The Inupiat are one of 11 distinct Alaska Native cultures among 220 villages, each with its own dialects, dances, and songs. Today you'll hear about the resilience and survival of the Inupiat in the face of repression. They overcame threats and destruction brought upon by the European and American expansion. Their lands were reclaimed and a movement of solidarity emerged, shifting the Alaska Native identity in a positive way. The Inupiat, meaning real or genuine, reside mainly in North and Northwest Alaska. Their dialect is closely related to the Canadian and Greenlandic dialects, which may be called Inuit. The Inupiat, or real people, are still hunting and gathering societies. Many of the people we speak with today are from villages so remote they are not accessible by road systems, but only by air travel. They continue to live off the land and sea, which is a host to a variety of mammals, birds, and fish.
The animals that give themselves to us, that, you know, make us who we are. That's why we're so protective of our ocean. The ocean is our garden. It's our identity as a people. The animals that give themselves to us provide food, housing, shelter, clothing. If we lose the animals, we lose our identity as a people.
That's Steve Umatuk of the Tikiak Traditional Dancers of Point Hope, Alaska. The drum and dance songs are composed straight from life. An observation or experience can move fluidly into song. When someone catches a whale, the first airplane that landed in the village, or the work of chopping wood. For the Tikiak Traditional Dancers, the style in which the songs are sung plays a big role as well. Tyreek Oviuk, who also performs with the Tikiak, explains this singing style, in which he sings with his nose.
When we're going out whaling, one of the things that was taught to me was that you put your paddle into the water and you could hear the sounds of the ocean. You could hear the bowhead whales, the beluga whales, you could hear the seals, the walruses, and there's these neat, eloquent sounds that you could feel like, man, I don't know what they're saying, but you could hear them communicating. And they're not only communicating to each other, but they're communicating to us. And a lot of those songs are a lot of high-pitched noises, like Northern Lights sounds or something like that. And it's a lot of bending and sliding. It's a lot of progressiveness to it. And so we try to copy that and emulate that while we're facing the whale liver membrane. I've been taught to sing with your nose to relate to the animals. A lot of dance groups, you know, like even within our own people, tonight I had to scold one of the guys who is, you know, although granted he's older than me, I've been dancing longer than him and I've learned the right way to do it. And I had to tell him, hey, dude, slow down here a little bit. Like, what's the rush? These people need to hear the songs the correct way, you know, and our songs, what we sing, believe it or not, they have notes and they have bending and sliding. And so that song, if you sung it in its proper way, Yang, Yeah. You see that, for example, it sounds much more beautiful, you know. You could see it too when you're watching. After performances, people will come up and say, man, thank you. I was feeling so down and out before I came here, but I don't know what happened, but like I could feel healing coming through my body. Our culture is about love. It's about sharing. And we just want to share our lives. And it's what it's all about, making moments in life and touching people's lives as well as being touched.
That's Tyreek Oviuk of the Tikiak Traditional Dancers. The Tikiak Traditional Dancers are from Point Hope, Alaska, where the whale is at the center of life. Their community is dependent upon the hunting of marine mammals for food. Whaling crews hunt bowhead in the spring, and whaling captains hold positions of respect in the village. Steve Umatuk was born and raised in Point Hope. His grandfather was a dancer, and Steve himself has been drumming and dancing for over 20 years.
This is a whale liver membrane. It's from the liver. It's split. The whale is the center of everything to us. Our dances, our songs, our houses, our feast grounds. We believe that the whale gives itself to us. Without the whale, we wouldn't be who we are today. The animals that give themselves to us. We're Tikiaomi people. We're considered one of the oldest continuous inhabitants on North America. We've been there for thousands of years. How we interact amongst ourselves as Tikiaomi people. Our culture, our traditions is still real strong. Our dances, our songs tell the stories. Our well remembering, the ivory handle. The moon, the tatkek is like the moon. The drum is like the moon. You put the 12 rounds of string, just like the cycle of a year.
The drum is the central part of Inupiaq drum and dance traditions. The drum head is traditionally made from whale liver membrane or walrus stomach lining stretched over a wooden frame. In more modern times, they use goatskin or seconite airplane fabric since it is more accessible and easier to maintain. In the far north Inupiaq communities, trees come in on the ocean. Driftwood is utilized for many things, including the frame of the drum. Drummers today use red oak or maple wood for their frames. The drum handle can be made from hardwood, ivory, or antlers. The stick that is used to beat the drum is traditionally made from driftwood or baleen. Today, hardwood, hickory, bamboo, or even bicycle flagpoles are used. The drum head, frame, handle, and stick are what create this power-beating instrument that for many people is a symbol of community and love. Here's a live performance of just one of the many Alaska Native drum and dance groups demonstrating this passion. The Tikiak Traditional Dancers of Point Hope, Alaska. That's the Tikiak Traditional Dancers performing live at Quarix Regional and Rural Providers Conference held in Nome, Alaska. Heidi Sanungatuk is a graduate student at Wesleyan University, specializing in ethnomusicology. She's writing her PhD dissertation on Inupiaq dance and music from an Indigenous perspective. Heidi also teaches a class called Music of Alaska Natives and Indigenous Peoples of the North, at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Here she describes drum and dance styles and how they differ among Alaska Native cultures.
Inupiaq drumming, the drum is a fairly large hoop of wood, and the drum head is struck with a beater that's struck from underneath the drum. The drummer will, you know, hold this long, slender stick underneath the drum, and it hits the rim of the drum as well as the drum head from underneath. Yupik drumming styles is more often from the top. They hit the drum head from the top side of the drum. And it's often a smaller stick as well, lighter stick.
Sort of creating a different tone.
It has a different sound to it, yeah.
Athabascan drum style is totally different.
Totally different. They have a round drum that they don't necessarily have a handle on the rim of the instrument. They make a handle out of the drum head itself, you know, tying the hide or whatever they use for the drum head. They tie it on the back and hold that. And then they have a beater that usually has either a round shape to it. It's also a stick, but they'll curve the end of the stick, or sometimes they'll have just a soft padding on it added on top of the stick. But they beat right on top of the drum, and the dancing style is completely different to Inupiaq style. And Inupiaq drumming styles is, every village is different, but like a general style characteristic is that, you know, they'll sing the song with the drummers tapping the edge of the drum very lightly through the first time through, and then they'll repeat the whole song with a really strong beat of the drum. And sometimes it's so strong you almost don't even hear the singing anymore because it's such a strong beat. The voices, they also sing louder with stronger voices, but sometimes you almost don't hear the voices because the drumming is so strong on the second time through.
Another song performed live from the Tikiak Traditional Dancers. These festivals not only celebrate culture, but also serve as a time to see family and old friends from neighboring villages. In a Inupiaq dance, men beat the drum while the dancers form rows and sing in unison. All dancers share similar patterns of movement. Women sway their arms gracefully. The men make powerful hand motions. Male dancers stomp their feet. The females stand, feet together, bending their knees to the beat. The dancers perform two main types of dances. Motion or acting dances are synchronized, and happy dances are improvised. The choreography tells a story. Every movement illustrates the meaning behind the song. Happy dances are considered invitational, where anyone that knows the basic hand movements is welcome to join in. The dancers perform in various groupings, sometimes as couples or in sets. In some dances, only men perform, and others just the women. Dancers wear traditional boots called mukluks and atikluks, or kusbuks, which are cloth parkas. Today, gloves are part of the dancers' attire as well. It is believed that this is for protection from spirits and also to show respect. Here's Tyreek Oviuk of the Tikiak Traditional Dancers, after his performance at the Koyaarik Regional and Rural Providers Conference.
What you've seen tonight was motion dances. We have about 12 different types of dances and ceremonies. That one in particular was the motion dances, which they call sayoktons. We've always been known to be the oldest village that has stayed in the same settlement throughout the history of time, and our songs, which some of them you've seen tonight, those are some of those that we have shared. Obviously, before Facebook and internet and technological advancement, our people shared stuff through song and dance. They shared stories. And so there's how many different dynamics that come with that healing, you know, spirituality, thankfulness, and a whole bunch of different perspectives.
And I noticed that audience members who aren't part of the group will know the songs and come out and dance.
In the North Slope region especially, you will see a lot of songs that are shared, and that most of those are based on just, we've been to different dance events together and we learn some certain songs and like, wow, we might like a song and we might go get permission from this other group and say, hey, can we do this? Now, the history of King Island and Point Hope is that our forefathers, as recently as the 1930s was the last time that they came over to Point Hope by umak, skin boat frame, made out of bearded seal skins or walrus skins, walrus stomachs. And they traveled to Point Hope just for this purpose, to share food, to develop relationships, to share songs. So our forefathers did that. a few of those songs that we sung tonight belong to King Island, and they perfectly well know that. But they don't, you know, come at us and say, you know, hey, you guys are doing our songs or whatever, because we have that mutual understanding that out of all dance groups in Alaska, us two have a unique relationship where we share songs. There's a few songs that we don't even know belong to King Island or to Point Hope. But what we do know is that they were traded amongst one another. And so it's not more so of a confusion thing. It's just we have that understanding that our people have a bond in that aspect.
About 40 miles off the western coast of Alaska, in the Bering Sea, is King Island. A small population of about 200 residents once lived there. On a hill by the water, their houses on stilts. They survived off the land and sea, with little contact with the white world, until the mid to late part of the 20th century, when they were pressured to relocate to Nome. The only school on the island closed in 1959 due to fear of a rock slide. With the school closure, harsh climate, and economic hardships, life was no longer sustainable. No one has lived on King Island since the 70s, making the village a ghost town. In Nome, however, the King Islanders' culture and identity thrives. They are known for their walrus hunting and ivory carving. Some still return to King Island during the summer. On the island, spring and summer were the important times of gathering, while winter was the time of dance. Here's the King Island dancers. Sylvester Ayuk grew up on King Island until he was 12 years old and now resides in Nome. He is a hunter and world-renowned sculptor, working in wood and ivory. Some of his works are now housed in museums in Alaska and Washington, D.C. His family left their island village when the school permanently closed. Sylvester and other King Islanders return most summers to connect once again with the land of their birth. The King Island dancers keep their home alive through song and dance. I spoke with Sylvester Ayuk about some of the styles of dance the group performs.
From King Island, you know, there are several dances, you know, we perform for different occasions. Very important one is polar bear celebration dance, which we don't do anymore, that we witnessed when we were growing up. When they get polar bear, you know, after waiting about a few days, you know, they have big celebration. The whole village would gather, you know, and have big feast celebrating polar bear kill.
And so you don't perform these songs anymore?
No, we don't. We don't live on the island anymore where they get polar bears by middle of the winter. But we preserve the polar bear songs that they compose for each hunter bringing home polar bear. They compose new songs, you know, for that particular polar bear every time, you know, one hunter brings in or kills a polar bear.
How old are some of your songs?
Some of the songs, you know, we do are a few centuries back. We still have at least 20 to 30 songs that are very ancient, and we don't know how far back they go.
And so how long have you been with the King Island dancers?
We started when we were real young on the island, before the islanders moved to mainland. I think, you know, for my peers and I, you know, we were around early teens when we start taking part in dances.
Are some of the people performing with you some of the originals from when you first started?
There are very few of us, you know, there's maybe one or two of us left. that the younger people depend on, you know, to carry on, to teach them what we've learned. And the hardest thing, you know, for me as a teacher and mentor is that we don't make songs, new songs anymore, which we experienced growing up on the island, you know, where many of the villages compose new songs, you know, for that winter. And we don't do that anymore. It's one of the hardest things, you know, I could try in my life. I've tried it for many years to compose or to make new songs, and I can't do it.
For indigenous traditional dance groups like the King Island Dancers, the people of the Wintering Place, etiquette is important. Singing the songs and performing the dances with respect, the way the composer meant them to be sung and performed. Some ancient songs are only performed with the permission of the song's creator or owner, which may be an individual or a group. Some songs are not performed in public, but held as sacred. Since the 18th century, Alaska Native people have been impacted by outside pressures, beginning with the Russian colonization and continuing when Alaska became a territory of the United States. European and American expansion into Alaska led to hardships for Alaska's Native people. I spoke with Dr. Sean Topcuck, an assistant professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks' School of Education. I wanted to get a better understanding of the negative impact that the repression of Native culture had on Alaska Native languages and traditional drum and dance. Dr. Topcuck is also the founder and leader of the Pavanupiak Dancers of Fairbanks.
Several factors that is involved with the disruption of the passing on of the traditional knowledge of any kind of dancing. One, some missionaries forbade the dancing because they thought it was demonic. Two, a lot of villages got sick due to various epidemics, influenza, other epidemics. So a lot of the cultural knowledge bearers, they died off and weren't able to pass on these traditions. Three, we had, because of the educational system, they had to send students away from their home villages to get a Western education. And so they did not have the cultural bearers from their own villages to be able to pass down these dances, not only the dances, but also the other cultural knowledge, food preservation, language, various other things.
In Anchorage, Cordelia Kelly and Miles Creed run an informal language circle called the Anchorage Language Group. They are working with Alaska Native Heritage Center's Urban Eskimo Revitalization Language Grant Project. They also run a Facebook page called the Inupiaq Phrase of the Day. I talked to them about the negative impact that the repression had on Alaska Native languages and traditional drum and dance.
Alaska, it's so large that each part of the state has different histories and different influences in colonialism that happened in a variety of different ways. And so it really does differ from region to region. Up north, there was first contact with Yankee whalers, for example, whereas maybe in other parts of the state, you know, it was the Russians that came prior. Using the North Slope as an example, you know, first there was the Yankee whalers and that wave of outside influence and introducing different substances or different ways of being and different diseases specifically that decimated the population on the North Slope, thousands and thousands and thousands of people dying. There was a census done by the U.S. government at the turn of the century, and it estimated tens of thousands of people living on the North Slope. But at the time of enrollment of the North Slope with the land claim settlement, there was about 3,500 shareholders that were enrolled. So if you can think about all of the people that died, and you have elders talking about being a child in Barrow and kicking around skulls of people because there was just so many people that died so quickly that they couldn't be buried at all, and they thought that was normal.
There was just more than a century. A lot of people argue that it's still continuing of cultural repression in Alaska. And part of that was really strict punishment for speaking Inupiaq language or speaking any Alaska Native language. And people all over the state of Alaska were sent to boarding schools in high school or younger to other places completely separate from where they're from in Alaska and outside of Alaska, Chemawa Indian School, even to the East Coast in Pennsylvania. People were taken from their communities and basically told to assimilate into white American culture and language, which was English. And so, I mean, we see this with the people that we work with who are still fluent speakers, that there's a lot of trauma with even speaking the language. One of the elders that we worked with says it's really hard for her to speak her language sometimes because she can taste the soap in her mouth when she speaks Inupiaq. And so that's something that's really difficult to come up against when you're trying to work in language revitalization and create pride around language. And there has been so much trauma associated with it and so much kind of hatred towards indigenous languages in Alaska.
These actions have very strong effects on people today, mm-hmm. and are very recent. People who have been affected by the message that your culture is wrong, you know, your language is wrong, this is the right way. Last week, even, I called up an elder, a young elder, to be involved in some language efforts here in Anchorage, and I introduced myself in Inupiaq, and this person is probably in their 60s, so not very old at all. And she began crying because I introduced myself in Inupiaq, and I was asking her simple questions in Inupiaq, and she cried, and she couldn't continue the conversation because of the pain that she remembered as a youth in school and being told that she was not allowed to talk in the only way she knew how to talk anymore. The strict prohibition of speaking in native languages, and furthermore, the strict prohibition of dance, mm-hmm. because they could see what effect these dances and these songs had on the community and how powerful they were. And because that was foreign and because that was different, it must be wrong. It must be related to, you know, the Christian idea of Satan, basically. But really, to see these songs in action in a community really shows it's a measure of the health of that community and that robustness of that community. Because when you bring the community together for a time of dancing and singing these songs, it unifies the community and it refreshes the community. And the drum beat really mimics the heartbeat. And that's why it's, you know, the heartbeat of the community.
This is the Alaska Native Heritage Dancers with a traditional vocable song from the North Slope called Aya Aya off the album Our Dance. Heidi Sanungatuk, a professor of ethnomusicology at the University of Alaska Anchorage, tells us about her family's experience.
My grandparents were affected by the flu influenza epidemic that happened in 1918. My grandparents were orphaned in that flu, and so a lot of the elders and the knowledgeable people of that era just simply passed away due to illness, and very quickly. So many people passed away, and so a lot of the knowledge about the music and dance, just people died and they took the information with them to the grave. So that was a big loss for a lot of places in Alaska. In the next generation, so my father grew up in Wales until he was about 15, and about that time, the Mount Edgecombe School was opened near Sitka, Alaska, and somebody thought it would be a really good idea for Ron, my dad, to go to school, because in Wales they only had school up through the eighth grade. So if you wanted to pursue higher education, you had to go elsewhere. And some people went to places such as Chemawa in Oregon or the Carlisle School. These are native boarding schools run by the Bureau of Indian Education. So this school in Mount Edgecombe was also a new school in the 40s. So they asked him if he would want to go. My grandparents thought it would be a good idea for him to go to school there. So he went as a 15-year-old freshman in high school, and he really never went back to Wales after that. He's one of this generation of people that left the village for the purpose of going to school, because there was no other option. If you wanted to pursue education, you had to leave the village at that time. And so a lot of people moved away. Yeah.
And do you think because so many people moved away from these villages that they lost the opportunity to speak more of this language fluently?
Yes, absolutely. The language was suppressed. When he went to school in Mount Edgecombe, they were having an English-only policy there. And my dad was telling me the other day that he feels he missed out on learning important skills like hunting, traditional hunting skills, because he left right at that crucial age. And so he lost things like knowing how to hunt. He lost things like developing his language skills. And he knows that the language that he uses in Inupiaq today, it kind of stopped at age 15. So it's not all that developed. You know, it's sort of teenage language. I ask him to translate for me sometimes, and he can't really translate directly because he doesn't know what they would be in Inupiaq language because he didn't learn it as an adult.
Up ahead, we look at how a modern Alaskan political and cultural resurgence began in the 1960s and 70s that has led to a cultural renaissance for many Alaska Native communities.
They flexed their political muscles and for the first time in their colonial history realized they can affect change.
The indigenous people of Alaska got organized for the first time.
She said, maybe the ancestors are saying it's time for us to reclaim our songs and dances.
Welcome back. This is an Earth Songs documentary, Inupiaq Drum and Dance, a Cultural Renaissance. Maria Williams is the Director of Alaska Native Studies at the University of Alaska Anchorage. She received her PhD from UCLA, specializing in ethnomusicology. Maria describes what happened that influenced a cultural renaissance for many Alaska Native communities after Alaska Native leaders came together in the 1960s and 70s.
One of the things that really brought Alaska Native people, I think, together was with the Statehood Act. So all of these protests happened, and a miracle happened that the Tundra Times newspaper was created with Howard Rock, who was actually from Point Hope originally. It was funded by this East Coast millionaireess, Laverne Madigan, and it was an association, the AIA. And it was basically a group of philanthropists that were very sympathetic to a lot of American Indian or Native Americans that were dealing with land struggles and issues. And so they funded the Tundra Times. And if you look at any of those early Tundra Times covers, up for the first 10, 15 years, it was all about these horrible issues of Native people not having any say-so, not having any land claims. So it led to this land claims movement.
And let's talk about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. What was significant about this Land Claims Act?
So many people were involved, so many Native leaders. ANCSA, or the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, is very unique because it's social engineering, meaning Congress, rather than creating a reservation, which was the real common methodology in the 19th century, and pretty much I think all reservations were created in the 19th century in the United States, they thought, well, these Alaska Native people are sitting on oil. They've had gold. They have all these natural resources. Maybe they need to become capitalists. And maybe the model of a corporation might be the method to kind of bring them into the 20th century. The leadership at the time, I think they also felt, wait a minute, we want to move forward. You know, we want to take advantage. We do need viable economies. And so it was agreed upon that they would create these 12 regional corporations based on the different, you know, ethnic groups. But one of the things that to me was so fascinating is because of this Native solidarity movement of Alaska Native leaders coming together, sharing information, working together, really rolling up their sleeves, they became very empowered. They flexed their political muscles and for the first time in their colonial history realized they can affect change. And so I think there was a pretty powerful shift in identity, meaning that Alaska Native people began to feel, I'm proud to be Alaska Native and proud to claim my legacy. And so when these regional corporations or the associations met annually at their meetings, they'd almost always have a dance group. All of a sudden, it was something to be in a dance group. It was something of great pride. And in some cases, it led to the formation of a lot of dance groups. And in areas where there had been a lot of suppression, the young people began to actually form new dance groups. And
to me, it's just a testament to resiliency, survival, and bearing witness to this renaissance is pretty exciting. Seeing this growth, we're definitely, I think, moving in a really positive direction.
I spoke with Cordelia Kelly and Miles Creed, who work in Alaska Native language revitalization. Here they describe what Cordelia calls the healing generation.
You have so much, you know, systemic and historical trauma within our generation, but you also have a generation that's coming forth where there are people that are okay. The dust is kind of settling in some ways. And so you have what I call the healing generation, because I'm okay. My sisters are okay. We're going to have kids and our kids are going to be okay. And we're going to continue teaching the ways that we've been taught as well. And so that's one of the reasons why you see so many efforts right now with language revitalization, with dance revitalization, with certain communities having dance groups for the first time in, you know, generations.
A friend of mine just told me she was brought to tears by when Obama made a visit to Kotzebue recently. And she said that the most exciting part of Obama's visit wasn't actually him coming there, but was seeing the numbers of people who showed up at dance practice in the weeks beforehand. And she said it really brought her to tears to see how loud and powerful and meaningful the drumming and the dancing was in the lead up to visit from Obama, and that it was just something that felt like her as a resurgence in of Inupiaq dancing and drumming in Kotzebue. These are just really small efforts, like us having a language circle or people getting involved and getting dance groups started again. All these things are little movements that will create a big movement. And I think, and I hope that there's a lot of energy all across Alaska.
In Anchorage, the Kingitmute Dance Group works to reclaim their heritage and reinvigorate cultural traditions. The Kingitmute, people of the high place, are from the village of Wales, located on the Seward Peninsula, where Alaska stretches toward Siberia. Greg Nothstein, encouraged by Paul Tialana of the King Island Dance Group, traveled to Wales with his mother and cousin in order to discover and reclaim traditional songs.
Story goes, as I found my grandfather's grave here in Anchorage, out in Clatt Road, and I was inspired to sing and dance because I wanted to know if there were songs and dances from Wales. And when I asked Paul Tialana about the idea of practicing with the King Island Dance Group, he didn't say yes or no. He just said, "I remember when I was a boy." He went right into a story. You know how elders are. And not wanting to hurt my feelings, he just said, "Yeah, when I was a boy, we used to enjoy riding in the bow of the kayak from King Island to Wales. Kind of like you kids like to hang out in the malls nowadays, but it was more fun for us." And he said, "I remember in the Kajgi, the loud drumming and singing going on when we were visiting, and the graceful movements of all the Wales women. You know, I bet you there's children who were my age back then who still remember the songs and dances. And maybe you can go and ask them if they still remember." And I told my mother this, and she said, "Maybe the ancestors are saying it's time for us to reclaim our songs and dances." Richard Aituk and Mom had a conversation about it. They decided that it would be a good idea to go back to Wales and do this, and we'll see if we can start reviving or doing something to reclaim them. And I told my cousin, who I was spending the night with, about our plans, and she said, "Make sure you guys record it." I said, "That's a good idea." She said, "You have a camcorder?" I said, "No, we don't. We're just going there." He says, No. "Here, you can borrow my camcorder." And I borrowed her camcorder and informed my mother, and then we purchased some 8mm film. We only had enough for maybe three. It was really expensive back in the 90s. And we spent 2 days learning one song and videotaping other songs that other elders remembered. For the 2 days that Richard and my mother were there, they wanted to go back. I said, I'll go back tomorrow and I'll catch up with you at Nome. I got weathered in. I got weathered in Wales. And I recorded some more songs while I was there, maybe six of them at most. And we came back to Anchorage. We reviewed them, and we practiced as best we could with makeshift drums that we made from fabric and wood.
And so what has it been like reclaiming these songs?
The experiences we had reclaiming our songs and dances of Wales was trial and tribulation. Some of them were really embarrassing in front of the people or the public, but still we had to laugh at those because it's only through perseverance or practice that we reclaim these. I mean, you know, you look back at that stuff and go, wow, we survived that. If that's the worst it gets to reclaim your heritage and your shared heritage, then the price is great. I mean, what better price is there than to do that? Otherwise, you can only imagine the price of regret that it took when elders who were children back then, who were stopped from singing and dancing, and that great disappointment, that great despair that just kind of sat there. Our children are never going to know their language or their songs and dances ever again. But, you know, when I sat at my grandfather's grave, when I found it, inspiring thought just overcame me. And I said, well, okay, I'll look into it. Because they always said, elders always talked about this. If you need help, you should talk to your elders. Okay, well, I'll call them on that. And I'm glad I did. And then followed up. And as a result, we've received songs and dances from Point Hope, Little Dimey, and I think some from Teller. But when Paul Tialano was alive, he said there are dance groups and communities of Wainwright all across the North Slope singing Wales songs. Even our King Island group sang some of the Wales songs because we traded songs. I bet you if you went back to your mother's village and found any of those elders who are still alive, they may remember some of those songs and you can revive them.
And is there a mission you have as a group?
My mother said it best. I can only paraphrase. She said, our mission is to continue to sing the songs of the Kingic Mute and to be examples to others that if you have songs and dances that you've never heard from your village for a while, you too can reclaim them.
The Kingic Mute dance group was kind enough to let me sit in on one of their practice sessions. This song is called Utena, or Goodbye. Utena, who was the last chief of Wales, announces his travel to Kotzebue, and the village holds a dance for him. The ladies braid their hair and wave goodbye to him. The song was composed by two cousins and was one of the first full song stories the group learned. Here's the Kingic Mute dance group of Wales, Alaska with Utena. The Shishmaref Eskimo Dance Group is a new and emerging group. Shishmaref is a tiny village in northwest Alaska, located on an island 5 miles from the mainland. The main mode of travel to the village is via expensive air travel. The island has dealt with erosion issues since the 1950s, which has done damage to the land and caused houses to fall into sea. Eskimo dancing is a critical extracurricular activity for the adults and youth of the community. The group is passionate about promoting a healthy pastime and preserving their cultural ways. The Shishmaref dancers are working hard to restore their own traditional dances that were once lost. I sat down with Mina Eninguk and Ruth and Jared Nayukbuk of the Shishmaref Eskimo Dance Group. Ruth tells us about their experience growing up dancing, but first, here's a live performance from the Shishmaref Eskimo Dance Group.
Thank you. When we were small, we used to dance with my grandpa, Isa Wiawana. He was a real big part of the group. Trying to get it going, we had a few songs. And then my grandpa died in 97, and we quit dancing until Mary Huntington came back to town after she was done with college. And then she got it going again. We were real young when we were dancing with her. Grade school, middle school. We were small when we traveled with her. About 20 years ago, she came back from school, and she was taught a lot of dances while she was there. And then she moved. Our dance group quit. She came back. We started again. She moved again. And now we're keeping it since we have more men interested in singing. When we first started out, it was all ladies singing with maybe few young little boys. It's progressing into all men singing now, finally.
And the thing I really enjoy about your group is that there are so many kids involved and they're really enthusiastic about it.
Yep, when we're home and we perform at home, our gym is full of children dancing. They have a lot of interest in it now. Jared did it at the school while he was working at the school.
Fourth and sixth grade.
Yeah.
Every, like, couple times a week during their PE time. That got him really interested. The fifth grade class performed Eskimo dancing for their Christmas play at the school. But it was pretty awesome. With his help.
No, we just had practice like every Saturday during the evening.
Sometimes twice a week. They just became interested one day. That inspired us all too, I think.
And there was a moment in your performance when all the men got up to dance and the young boys took over drumming and singing. What inspired that?
We just did that one practice.
One practice, one time, and the boys
sure
enjoyed
it. Because we took a break. And the boys started drumming and singing, and it was awesome.
And in one of the songs, the boys were doing, like, walrus noises?
That song, we learned that from the Russians.
Yeah.
That was one of the songs they said that we could use.
What really inspired me is those old tapes when the Russians came. Really got me watching them and trying to learn those songs and the tapes. Well, since our songs are mostly dead, that's all we can try to keep our dancing going.
So some of these songs you learned from Russian dancers?
Mm-hmm.
We have a few that were kept alive that are originally from Shishmaref. And then we have a couple from what we learned from Point Hope that were traded to Point Hope a long time ago. And they kept them alive and they were slowly teaching us what they were. Songs being traded, that's what they used to do a long time ago, everywhere.
Though some of the history of the dance group is still to be learned, the Shishmaref Eskimo Dance Group finds it important to keep dancing. In this live performance, the young boys take over drumming and singing while their teachers guide them and dance. Alaska, Brian Muktoyuk, who drums and dances with the King Island Eskimo Dancers, has found a new way of incorporating his Inupiaq drum. He and lifelong friend Arlo Hannigan come together to create Freshwater, an exploratory and experimental album. The two combine Hannigan's melodies, lyrics, and guitar with Muktoyuk's native vocables and Inupiaq drum. In the album Freshwater, Muktoyuk shares his heritage and what he's learned from his elders. From the album, this is Song Spirit.
learned it from your elders. It's got a real meaning to it because you got taught the right way. There's a certain way that you dance in order for it to be your own. That's the only way that I know how to do it. It's the way that my forefathers have taught me.
Oh, the bounty you shall find all the way to paradise. On the mountain to climb, I know you can. Spirit will find me, I know you can. Spirit will find me.
You have to let the song come to you. You can't force it. You have to let it come to you.
For that song, when I first started to write the melody, I kind of thought about where do I go in my mind when I'm trying to access these songs that are waiting to be written. Where do I go for that? And our two takes on this piece of work kind of came together nicely. And so actually with this song, Brian's vocals imitate the cello line.
Yeah.
So that was kind of different about this tune. And for that, with my vocals on this one, I kind of stepped back and just stayed in the framework.
It's about how you let the song come to you. Each song has a spirit in it. Like my people, we don't write our songs down. They're passed down from generation to generation by listening. We have no written language. It's all taught orally. That's something that you have to grow up doing. And nowadays, you're going to have to want to learn it because it's really hard to learn. It's just picking up where someone left off, pretty much. My grandfather, Gabriel Muktoyuk Sr., was the chief of our community for many years, and he was also the leader of our dance group. And so I pretty much was raised into it. I started very early when I was 1 or 2 years old, maybe even 3. So I grew up listening to it and living it and just being a little Eskimo dancer. For the respect of the song and the composer, we sing it the way it was intended to be sung.
Yeah, Brian was like a legend from, you know, when he was a kid. People were really amazed by his passion. Including me. You know, as a kid, I just would sit back and I'd try to go, you know, to as much as I could in Nome and see King Island. And I never thought that I would be a part of it, but it still felt like it was kind of a part of, you know, how I grew up because that was what was happening in the town.
And we hung out a lot when we were kids in elementary school. You know, we'd have sleepovers and hang out. And we just grew up together. You know, we were the same class for a long time. It's just, you know, friendship grew into brotherhood. You know, now he's my brother.
Another great song from the album is their self-titled track, Freshwater.
And one of the stories when I was growing up was the respect they had for the animals that they hunted. And one story was about a hunter going out and catching a seal.
She came up for fresh water. She came up and met our father. This is the water that we must drink. This is the food that we must eat. When you come out from your spell, come out from your spell, come out from your spell, come out from your spell. 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 Come out from your spell.
This is actually one of my favorites off the album. I think it is my favorite. When you really listen to that song, that is a really emotional track. Can you tell us about it?
That song is emotional. I probably text Brian once every 6 weeks saying, listen to Fresh Water. Got tears in my eyes.
Yeah. And you know, the funny thing about it is that song almost never made it on the album. We thought it wasn't ready, but after I listened to it a couple of times,
I thought, man, this is going to be one of the best songs on the album. You know, it's a story about a hunter going out and catching a seal, the respect that he has for the seal. They come up for fresh water. They give themselves to you so you could give them water. And after you take the animal and you kill the animal, you respect it by giving it water so the soul of the animal could go back down and tell the others they got fresh water up there, and that's why the animals keep coming back, so they could have that fresh water. All over Alaska, each culture has a similar story to that. They've heard it from their elders.
She came up for fresh water. She came up and met our father.
Yeah, that song is takes the story and then it sort of encompasses, you can kind of picture the youth in Nome. It has this circle of life, beginning and end, and you can take that story, and then when Brian starts talking about his drum, it's a circle, it has no end, it's infinite. You start to see how the songs are kind of threaded together.
The drum will heal your soul. That's why I play it. I play it for you. This drum was made for you guys. That's why I play it. I don't play it for myself. I play it for people that need it, that need the spiritual healing. That's why I do it.
When you come out from your spell, come out from your spell, come out from your spell. Come out from the 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 spell.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Alexis Salih. This has been an Earth Songs documentary, Inupiaq Drum and Dance, A Cultural Renaissance. Special thanks to the dance groups and individuals who contributed to the making of this program. This project is supported in part by a grant from the Alaska Humanities Forum and the National Endowment for Humanities, a federal agency, and by the Siri Foundation, supporting educational dreams since 1982.
Earth Songs is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, a nonprofit native media organization based in Anchorage, Alaska. The producer is Alexis Salih.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.